Mr. McGowan.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew J. McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Matthew Schuster. Mr. Schuster appeals a few of the district court's loss determinations as well as a related restitution determination. Unless there are any questions about the loss amounts related to victims assisting the prosecution both before and during sentencing, I intend to address the loss determinations before October 1st, 2003. Mr. Schuster's offense of conviction was based on his assuming access codes, that is to say, IP addresses and MAC addresses, of other customers of a wireless internet provider. He assumed these people's identities from the record on September 30th, sometime late in the day, and people started complaining October 1st of 2003.
But didn't the testimony indicate that Mr. Schuster was using Fisher's MAC address on September 30th?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. What I believe the record reflects is that he was identified by a representative of Alpha, the company that services the network, or not the internet service, as using it. Now, Mr. Kell, in the evidence that we have in the record, does not identify how he knows, except there's a user identifier identified to Mr. Schuster. And in fact, it's consistent with the evidence that he was using a particular IP address all through the spring and summer of 2003. There's no indication until he was cut off that he was using other people's identifiers, their IP address or MAC address.
But isn't there sufficient evidence to hold him responsible in that he had authorized access to the system and the ability and motive to cause problems prior to October 1st. And the problems experienced during September seem to be technically inexplicable and ceased once his equipment was seized.
Well, Your Honor raises a number of points. I don't believe he had a incentive to do what he did after September 30th before, because he was using the service provider for free access, just like somebody would be using a cable if they weren't paying for it, but the cable company hadn't been able to cut them off physically. And he liked to play a game that took a lot of time. I mean, there's one indication that he was playing for 66 hours, I believe, in a week, this game. So I think the incentive for him was actually to stay below the radar by not causing problems. The other portion of your question had to do with it stopped when he was taken off. And to some extent that's true. However, the evidence that that we have on this is as Mr. Brodsky, who ran and served and worked with Alpha, he explained that, yes, that a lot of the problems left, but he didn't say that they all left. And he said what he was able to do was able to determine them a little bit better. And the other thing to keep in mind is T.D. Fisher is the only company that asked for damages or loss amounts, in this case, before October 1st. And they were off the wireless network by the 3rd of October. So by the 6th, when Mr. Schuster was arrested, we don't know whether they would have had the same problems. The other thing is, in the record, there is another person who testified that he used that same internet service and had trouble all the way through 2004 and 2005 of a similar nature. The other problem with this record is that although there are some symptoms about what people were having problems with before October 1st, there's no indication of what those symptoms were caused by. They just couldn't figure it out. And I just don't believe that that's a basis to determine that Mr. Schuster should be responsible for them. The other thing that I'd like to address is the court's finding that he did use the wireless service provider in a way that interfered with the customers, likely to interfere, I believe the court said. And along those same lines. There's just no evidence of what he was doing other than just playing this game and not downloading pictures, which is what everybody else, well, not the pictures necessarily or the game specifically, but the kinds of things he was doing don't necessarily interfere with this wireless service. I would like to address also this business about the MAC address, because that's important. The government contends in their brief that there's no evidence that he had a particular MAC address that was identifiable to him throughout the summer. However, Brodsky testified inadvertently, but he testified that before the problem occurred on September 30th, he did have a MAC address. And the government hasn't addressed why that's not persuasive or telling in this case. And to the extent that the government argues that, well, that doesn't mean that he couldn't have been using it, that's true. But on the other hand, as I said, there's more of an indication that he was using this just to, in a way, to get back at the company, but just using it for free until they cut him off. There's one other point that the government makes that I'd like to address just briefly. To support the witnesses, which, you know, for the most part, we believe the witnesses and don't this is not a credibility problem. But the government says that he attacks the same customers after October, after he's cut off, that he does before. However, only T.D. Fisher submitted losses pre-October 1st, and T.D. Fisher had problems all throughout. In fact, he decided to change Internet service providers 2 months before September. They'd actually signed the contract on the 24th of September and physically changed to a different service provider on October 3rd. Unless there are any questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning. Tim O'Shea for the United States. I will follow the defense counsel's lead and stick with that particular category of laws that relates to duration. I will, however, observe that the defendant suggests that the relevant conduct loss is $8,956. Because the district court found that the relevant conduct loss was more than $10,000, the disputed amount then is $1,044. The defendant must prevail on all three of its categories in order to drive drive the loss amount below $10,000.
I was wondering how, guideline section 2B, 0.11, the application note 3 could have any meaning, unless it means that the loss calculation can't include amounts that are based on victim participation in the prosecution and investigation. I don't.
All right. Well, let me jump ahead to that. Sure. There's the second. Actually, this would be. You look at it, the third category of loss. It's the $2,700 loss to Mr. Brodsky based on the time spent helping law enforcement. And this is a
plus the $1,400 for the.
Right.
The two to testify.
Right. I would respectfully submit that those are two different things, but let's deal with them individually, and if they're the same, we'll sort that out at the end. Nothing in Attorney Dallier's objection to the court about the $2,700, that's really the helping the law enforcement and the prosecution understand the technology and all that. It was required, perhaps because I was the assistant, it required a lot of hand-holding on the part of the victim to help me and the FBI agent understand it.
Yeah, but that's victim's travel, et cetera.
Well, no, that's just us sitting in his office and
okay.
He's explaining to it for the most part. Or coming over to the FBI, but it's just, it's 5 minutes away in Wausau, Wisconsin. But we really have, in these application notes, we have a clash of absolutes. On the one hand, we have one application note that is 3AV, which indicates that loss shall include all reasonably foreseeable pecuniary harms, and it says that it shall include All right. And then it gets to Roman numeral 3. It applies in these types of cases, 18 U.S.C. section 1030. It shall include all reasonable costs to any victim because of an interruption of service. So that seems absolute going in one direction. It, absolute going in the other direction is the one the court references, and that is application note 3DII, which indicates loss shall not include cost of victims primarily to aid the government in the investigation or prosecution of the offense. So we've got a clash of absolutes. Now, I suggest that that this is reviewed for plain error because Mr. Delye, the counsel before, didn't say anything to the court to challenge this. He said nothing in his cross of Brzezinski concerning this amount. So I suggest that the plain error should apply for this case. Now, and because we've got a clash of absolutes here, I respectfully submit that if there's error, it's not plain, it's not obvious how to resolve this. Even if the defendant is right, and I got to tell you, Attorney McGowan's got some good arguments why his view should prevail, but those arguments weren't made to the district court. You really have to give the district court a chance to resolve a dispute. Even if the defendant is right, he cannot show that any error affected his substantial rights.
So should the case be remanded for resentencing and to give the district court that chance?
Well, that'd be one way to do it. This court has held, though, that, you know, you really get one kick at the cat. The court told me that and told defendants lots of times as well. Look, if you don't bring it up to the district court, then you have either waived or forfeited it. And if it doesn't affect the substantial rights, that is, if it doesn't affect that $10,000 threshold, then it's either harmless error or not affecting the substantial rights. Either way, I respectfully submit that one's a wash. I don't think coming down to testify at sentencing, and that's the $1,400 figure, and I see that as different, Your Honor. I don't think that can be lumped together with Mr. Brzezinski explaining to us for a couple different reasons. That is not primarily to the government in the prosecution or investigation of an offense. It came down, you know, the but-for cause of their attendance is the defendant, you know, attacking Central Wisconsin Wireless Internet and also attacking, interfering with the manufacturer, T.D. Fisher. And he subpoenaed them, not me. You know, that's a secondary reason. They were clearly on the government side. There's no doubt about it, and I had the burden of proof, and I called them. But they complied with the subpoena based on the defense request. And the but-for reason for their attendance is the defendant's attack. And I think that clearly falls within the 2B1.1, the first one that we talked about, the first application note. Now, the district court, I respectfully submit, was correct for five different reasons, and including the total of T.D. Fisher's loss amounts. And that's based on the defendant's statements that he kept his equipment up to harm the wireless provider, and it's also consistent with his statements in his little EverQuest chat log as he is playing his game. Also, the defendant was caught red-handed disrupting T.D. Fisher and others in the first week of October. Next, the district court was not clearly erroneous in the absence of any technical explanation for the idiosyncratic attacks before October 1, and as the court says, they disappeared once the police went over there and took away his computer and his wireless equipment. And then finally, we've got the live in-court testimony of Mr. Brzezinski and Mr. Fisher in the district court's decision to believe them and to find that they corroborate each other and they're corroborated by other things is not clearly erroneous. So that's it. Any questions of the court? Thank you very much for your attention. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Anything further, Mr. McGowan?
Unless the court has any questions, no.
Looks like we don't. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.